I was just thinking about tipping horses in the Derby at Epsom. Sorry, hello, Cornelius here. Cornelius Lysard on the Cornelius Cast. Yeah, as I said, I was thinking about tipping, fancying, selecting horses in the Derby at Epsom since my first Derby working, which was Generous's Derby in 1991. I remember Lamtara keen on that one. Oath with Kieran Fallon riding in 1999. Galileo, See the Stars 2009. Golden Horn, certainly, Frankie Dettori's second success in 2015. That wasn't stopped by being my selection, nor was Massa in 2018, nor in 2006 was Sir Percy, trained by Marcus Tregoning for owners Anthony and Vicky Pakenham, whose lilac and white silks were worn by Martin Dwyer, and that was probably the narrowest victory in the 240-year history of the Derby. And 14 years on from Sir Percy, Martin Dwyer is riding in the race again on Pile Driver, and I'm delighted to say that the Derby winner at Epsom, the Oaks winner at Epsom, the racing's best-known Evertonian, also renowned wit, raconteur and joker Martin Dwyer has been good enough to join us on the Cornelius Cast today. How's that for an intro?
That was some intro, that was some build-up. You didn't call me what you normally call me.
Anyway, we're recording this at the start of Derby week, but we're also, talking of derbies, recording it a few days after Liverpool were confirmed as winners of the Premier League. As I say, you're probably racing's best-known Evertonian. So have you been out shaking hands, congratulating lots of Liverpool fans?
No, I'm taking the social distancing rules very seriously. I'm not going near any Liverpool fans at all. The best way to handle it is just I'm in complete denial. It just never happened.
And one of your best friends is Franny Norton, the jockey. Now, he is a red, so you're steering clear of him?
Yeah, steer clear, as far away from... I've added a couple of extra metres to the social distancing for Liverpool fans especially. So I'm kind of staying 5 or 6 metres away from them at all times, if possible.
And as they were winning last week, were you in denial at that point? Were you hiding behind the sofa, or were you cheering on? What was it? It was Chelsea against City, wasn't it? Were you cheering on City?
I was watching it. I was staying with Jamie Spencer in Newmarket. We watched it together, and he was as annoyed as I was. So as soon as the final whistle went, phone was off, and I went to bed, and I didn't turn the phone back on till about 9 o'clock the next morning. Missed calls off my agents, trainers, and a lot of people, but I just couldn't bring myself to listen to the Liverpool fans.
And you said Jamie Spencer, your colleague and friend, was annoyed as well. Is he? Have you managed to indoctrinate him into being an Evertonian?
Yeah, I try and spread the word of And listen, most people, nobody likes Liverpool, do they? I mean, they don't even like themselves. Everyone wanted to see if they could drag it out and maybe the wheels would fall off. But they were going to win eventually, weren't they? So let them win on a Thursday night and let's forget about it.
And what about we banter amongst sports people, whether it's jockeys or footballers or whoever, is renowned. So is there quite a lot of banter, you being a well-known Evertonian, is there quite a lot of banter in the jockeys' changing room with you at the centre of it? Because Everton, it's quite a long time now since they won any silverware.
Yeah, no, I get plenty of stick. It's not easy being an Everton fan, as which you know, Cornelius. You're a blue as well, let's not forget that.
I'm thoroughly impartial on these occasions.
No, well, I have to put up with the likes of Mick Quinn and Paul Hannigan and Franny Norton. We'll never hear the end of it, will we? They say you'll never walk alone. We'll never hear the end of it.
And we can tell by your football allegiance and by your accent as well that you are a Merseyside person. So are you born, bred, dragged up, whatever you want to call it, all of it on Merseyside?
Yeah, I was born in Vazakley Hospital, which pretty much overlooks Aintree Racecourse, very close to Everton's ground. And there's a saying in Liverpool, you're either born a blue or you become a red. So I was born a blue through and through. Born in Vazakley, lived around that area and moved to Highton. Spent most of my childhood in Whiston, which is just on the outskirts of Liverpool, but still not far from the ground. So yeah, I used to go as often as I could.
And are you from a blue family? Were you always going to be an Evertonian?
Yeah, like I say, I was born a blue. My dad was a blue, avid follower, and all the family. I think there's only one of my uncles is a Liverpool fan, but he never goes to the game, so that's about That's about normal. But he's the only one. He's the only black sheep in the family.
And do you remember going to Goodison for the first time?
Yeah, I do. We used to go. My dad used to take me. He used to go with my mates. We used to sit in the back then, as you remember, there was no seating, and we used to stand in the Gladys Street end. And of course, only being about 3.5 foot, couldn't see much. So they'd let you go to the front, and we'd climb up and sit on the railings because we were all enclosed. So I'd spend most of the time sat on the rails, and the stewards would come and try and get you to knock you down, but you'd climb back up after they went. But that's where I watched most of the games from.
And you rode this pile driver, and we're going to talk about the Derby in a minute. you rode pile driver who threw down his sort of Derby gauntlet by winning the Edward VII Stakes of Royal Ascot. And Everton Football Club tweeted their congratulations to you. Now, it's been quite sort of picked up, and you said to me that night, and I'm still not quite certain how serious you were. You said this was like having a message from the Queen saying, well done.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was great. You know, I enjoyed that. I mean, Everton's a big part of my life, always have been. And yeah, it was quite an honour to get a message from the club saying, well done. And yeah, I did. I said to you, it was as good as getting a message from the Queen, if not better. It meant a lot to me.
So you sort of you glowed with pride, did you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's great. I love going back to Liverpool. I like going to the training ground. I know a few people within the club, and I love going to the training ground and seeing behind the scenes. Because I remember when I was a kid, my dad used to take me to the old training ground, Belfield, and we used to stand outside, and the gates, the big iron gates, would open, and the players would be leaving in the Ford Granadas and the flash cars of the day, and we'd try and stop them and get an autograph. And I used to think that was amazing. So to actually, all these years later, to kind of have friends in the club and be involved and get to go behind the scenes, it's a childhood dream come true.
So what players wound down their windows and signed your notepad, or perhaps more relevantly, who didn't?
Well, not many of them refused. Adrian Heath, I was a big fan of him. Graeme Sharp, Kevin Sheedy, who are now classed as a friend. He's a coach at Everton, and I speak to him regularly. He's a good guy, Sheeds. And yeah, you know, some good memories. But yeah, it's amazing how things change, isn't it?
And did you dream of, I know the answer to this, did you dream of scoring the winner in the derby at Goodison against Liverpool so you were going to beat them 5-0 or something? Was that your dream as a child?
As you know, my wife Claire, she thinks I've got a problem. She says I need help because she's woke me up before, and I've told her off for waking me up. I was in the middle of a good dream. I've had dreams that I'm the centre forward for Everton, record goal scorer, scored a hat trick against Liverpool. I've had these dreams where I'm going to be sold to Barcelona, so I refused to go. I said, if you're going to sell me, I'm going to retire. I'm not going to play football again. And all the fans were outside having a protest, and I came out. And you know, I've had these vivid dreams, which I think maybe Claire's right. Maybe I do need help, but yeah, I've had some weird and wonderful dreams about playing for Everton.
And you have grown a bit since you were climbing on the railings at Goodison, but possibly not massively. So that was always going to be against you being a footballer, and probably for you being a jockey.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, growing up, I thought I always wanted to be a footballer, but two things held me back: my height, and I wasn't very good at football. But I think the lifestyle would have suited me.
Do you think?
As a professional footballer, yeah. So after that, I thought maybe I'd be a stuntman. I actually wanted to be a stuntman. So in a way, I've probably fulfilled half of that ambition.
So what sort of stunts did you have in your mind?
Well, I used to climb trees, do somersaults off garages and all kinds of things. Mainly for, you know, for a bet, I'd do anything. But I used to do all mad things like that. And I was always interested in horses. I remember we were on holiday in Wales, North Wales, at a holiday camp. And for a bet, there was horses grazing in a field. There was a massive stone wall. And I think for a 50p bet, I jumped on the back of one of the horses. I'd never ridden a horse. That was probably the first time. So I stood on this great big stone wall, and I jumped off, landed on the back of a horse, which obviously frightened the life out of it, slipped down its back end, and it kicked me back over the wall. And for the rest of the holiday, I had a massive horseshoe-shaped bruise on my chest. And my dad always said, that's good luck.
That's a true story, is it?
True story. It kicked me back over the wall, and I was led winded and in a bad way, and the other kids ran off. I heard one of them run off saying, quick, run, I think he's dead. So it could have been quite serious, but yeah, that was probably my first taste of horseback riding.
How old do you think you were?
Probably about 9. But I'd watched it, you know, in the cowboy films where he'd whistle his horse and the horse would come up behind the saloon and he'd jump off and land on it. That's what I was trying to do. It made sense in my mind.
And so you've got your horseshoe-shaped imprint on your chest. When did you decide that you actually wanted to do this more seriously than a holiday camp in North Wales?
Must have been about 14. You know, when you're coming to the end of your of school, the last year or two, and you have like a careers day. I remember the teacher. I'd never ridden. I hadn't learned to ride properly, but I remember the teacher asking everyone to stand up and say what they wanted to do. And so kids were standing up saying, I'm going to be an electrician, going to join the army, going to be a nurse, blah, blah, blah. And I stood up and I said, I'm going to be a jockey. And everybody laughed, the entire classroom laughed. And somebody shouted out, yeah, you'll be a jockstrap or something. And the teacher told me to, you know, I think you have to rethink and think of something a bit more realistic. And if anything, that probably spurred me on. So I decided to learn to ride. So I learned to ride at 14 and the rest is history.
And how did you rode famously as an apprentice jockey for the Royal Trainer Ian Balding, father of Andrew Balding, father of Claire Balding, and, you know, a family steeped in history. How did you end up there?
Yeah, well, I'd started riding out. I'd learned to ride at a local farm and I was getting into it. And then I did a few days. I started riding, working for a trainer in McGull in Liverpool called Mike O'Neill. I started doing a bit there and my dad kind of said, my father loved racing and he said, look, if you're going to do this, you need to do it properly and we need to get you a proper apprenticeship if we can. And he wrote a letter to Ian Balding asking if he'd take me on, to which he replied and said he would. So literally my dad drove me down to Kingsclere, kicked me out of the car, said, don't get into any trouble. And that was it. That's how we started.
And so Kingsclere, this sort of massive, historic, traditional racing stable. Mill Reef was trained there also. What sort of horses were there when you arrived?
It was probably a great period. Selkirk, Loxon was just starting out. So some really good horses. I mean, it was a massive eye-opener for me from where I come from to, like you say, I mean, you know Kingsclere as well as anyone. It's such a lovely place and it was a massive eye-opener, a massive change in my life, but it was the making of me, really. You know, I couldn't thank Ian and Emma enough for what they did. Yeah, I suppose I owe them everything because they taught me a lot, not just about racing, but about the world and how to conduct myself properly and get on in life.
So this is Ian and Emma, his wife. There's a story that you were sort of marched into the office on the first day and Ian said to you, what racing connection have you got, Dwyer? Because I think probably in those days, apprentices were probably addressed by their surname. And there is a story that you gave quite an amusing answer. Is it true? It's to do with a bicycle.
Yeah, well, obviously, Dwyer, it's an Irish name, and there's been quite a few jockeys and trainers with the same surname, Mark Dwyer, of course. And I was asked, you know, any connection with racing, and to which I responded, my dad once had his bike nicked from outside the bookies. Which is a true story because he started taking me with him to watch his bike.
And so you were suddenly hurled into this great big racing stable. I've just looked up 1996. I've got a clear memory of meeting you for the first time. You were riding as an apprentice in the Stewards' Cup at Goodwood, a horse called J&P, which finished 9th out of 30. It was beaten 6 1/4 lengths. Have you got recollection of that Stewards' Cup? Because JMP was quite a favourite horse at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I used to look after him. Yeah, that's a blast from the past. Yeah, JMP, I used to look after him and I got to ride him a bit. He was a difficult ride. He was a bit of a runaway. He was a sprinter. He only had two gears, fast and slow. I kind of learnt my trade on horses like him. He was really difficult ride. I actually remember one occasion going to post and I'm going as slow as I can and he got a run on with me and he kind of bolted the last bit and I'm going flat out. I was at York and all the horses are circling at the start and I went flat out and I hit the side of Ray Cochran's horse and fired him out of the saddle. Knocked him clean off his horse and fired him out of the saddle. He went absolutely bananas with me. So yeah, I got some good memories of that horse in particular.
And you, as I said, you know, I know you quite well, so it's partly tongue in cheek, but partly true, calling you a wit, a raconteur, and a joker, which is definitely your reputation latterly. Was that your reputation when you were a teenager at Kingsclere?
I don't know. It's the person I am, and I think the background where I come from. If you can't laugh, you'd only cry. In some occasions, especially being an Everton fan. So I've always liked to have a bit of fun and have a laugh and play tricks on people, and that's just something I've always done. Sometimes it got me into trouble. You know, I've been called a lot of things. Mrs. Balden, I think she nicknamed me Muppet, didn't she? She's called me Muppet on several occasions.
Because?
I don't know. You'll have to ask her. Maybe she just thinks I'm a Muppet. I suppose I do behave like that.
You said it's got you into trouble. So any stories that particularly jumped to your mind about your sense of humour getting you into difficulty?
Well, in the early days as an apprentice at Kingsclere, I remember the lady in the... We all lived in a hostel, and there was a lady in there who did the cooking, and she was she could be a bit moody. And she did say, let it be known, she didn't like spiders. So I found the biggest spider. It was massive, like a tarantula. And I found the spider and threw her at her, and she went absolutely bizbo. But I didn't realise she had a proper phobia. She locked herself in the pantry and didn't come out. You had to get the doctor to come up. So when I seen the doctor's car parked outside the hostel, I knew I was in trouble for that one. She went over to the office and she demanded that I be sacked. She said either he goes or I go. Unfortunately, at the time, Ian Balding took the view that he could replace her easier than me. So she left.
We haven't got that much time to chat, but we could, I suspect, with stories like that, go chatting for forever and ever. But Sir Percy, let's get on to the job at hand. Sir Percy won the Derby in 2006. You'd already won the Oaks for the Baldings, hadn't you? So you'd won the Oaks on, what was it, Casual Look?
That's right, Casual Look in 2003.
Yeah.
It was Andrew's first year training, wasn't it?
So Ian had retired... Andrew had taken over. So considering you'd been part of the furniture there for really quite a long time, to then go and win them a classic in the Suns, in Andrew's first season, Ian's son's first season, how good did that feel? Do you remember all the Balding family burst into tears on the telly?
Yeah, it was very special, wasn't it? Everyone, we were all there. Ian was there. Andrew had taken over the licence his first year, so to have a runner in a classic was great. And the fact she won, I think we were all a bit dumbstruck, weren't we? We were like, we just couldn't believe it. And then the emotional scenes, because Claire Balding was there working for the BBC at the time, and she had to interview Andrew, and they were speechless. And Ian Balding, he had tears in his eyes, which that struck me, because I'd known him as such a hard man, and to see him with tears in his eyes, it was a special moment. It was a big moment. Because classics are hard to come by.
Mm. So you'd won the Oaks. Tears in your eyes, or were you just found no signs in your eyes as you worked out your feet?
I was just over the moon. I was delighted. I was trying to, if I remember rightly, just trying to soak it all in. I couldn't quite believe it had happened.
So that the Oaks, the Phillies' only classic at Epsom. So, you know, the chance of winning a second Epsom classic. You know, just the likelihood of winning a second Epsom Classic. Lots of people haven't won any at all. So then only a few years later, Sir Percy comes along and goes and wins the Derby.
Yeah, I know. That was amazing. I mean, I've always been lucky at Epsom. I've always had a lot of... on the year I won the Oaks, I had three winners on that day. And I've always enjoyed riding at Epsom. And Sir Percy, he was a great two-year-old, unbeaten, won the Dewhurst. And so we knew we had a classic horse on our hands. And we went into... his three-year-old campaign, he ran in the Guineas and finished a good second to a superstar horse called George Washington. So we were heading for the Derby, really confident of a big run, and you know, I really thought he had a chance of winning. Against all the odds, it came off.
And it was a four-way finish. It was a real, it was a thriller to watch. So is it a blur now as you think back, or can you remember every manoeuvre, every inch of grass?
Yeah, I still remember it like it was yesterday. It's you forget a lot of races, but you don't forget races like that. I mean, it seemed during that week everything was going wrong that could go wrong. The horse was injured. I mean, he only got the green light to run a few days earlier because he had an injury which took him a long time to recover from. He was having physio around the clock, and we eventually got the go ahead. And then I had a fall the night before in the paddock at Bath, and I was injured. I think I'd cracked the rib, but I never got it x-rayed because I didn't want to hear any bad news. So I had to pass the doctor.
Well, I remember actually sending you a text on that Saturday morning saying, "Are you okay?" And you said, "Yes. Will you pass the doctor?" And do you remember your reply to the text, "Will you pass the doctor?"
Yeah. What did I say?
It would take Dr. Blinking Who and all his blinking Daleks to stop me riding this horse in the Derby today.
Yeah, no, I do remember that. I remember thinking in the morning, I was in a hot bath, I was loaded up with painkillers, and my phone kept ringing, lots of journalists and people asking me, was I going to be fit to ride? And it was a big worry, but I got to the races, did a few press-ups in front of the doctor, grimacing.
Were you grimacing?
Yeah, I was in a lot of pain. Ribs are really sore when you do them, but I wouldn't have rode the race if I wasn't able to do myself and horse justice. So I knew I'd be okay. And once the adrenaline's flowing, I didn't feel a thing. So I knew all I had to do was pass the doctor, which I did, obviously. So, you know, it was a bit of a scare because I thought, you know, I'm going to miss the ride in the Derby. And then we eventually got to post and he wouldn't go in the stalls. Don't know if you remember, but he would. And I thought, oh my God, what's going to go wrong now? I'm going to get struck by lightning in a minute. And he wouldn't go in. He was on his last chance. They were going to go without him. And we put a blindfold on him, which he'd never had on ever before, never needed after. And he went in with the blindfold. So once we were in, locked and loaded, I was like, oh, thank God. Now I've just got to get through the race.
And how did that just go like clockwork, or were there any dramas there? I remember you, right at the end, you had to nip up the inside, didn't you, to actually grab victory?
Yeah, it was, it was a full field that year, wasn't it? There was a lot of runners and it was a bit of scrimmaging early on, and I got a half-decent position I was happy with. But then coming down the hill, there was a bit of bumping and barging and I got a little bit of interference. I got shuffled back a bit. And then when we turned in, they kicked for home quite soon. I remember Dylan Thomas, Johnny Murta was making the running. He kicked really quite early. So the race started to unfold as soon as we turned in. And I was a bit further back than I wanted to be. And he started to pick up well. And then I reached a point where I still had plenty of ground to make up. And I looked ahead of me and I thought, well, I can go round these horses and go up the camber, and I might be an unlucky second or third, or I can go for everything and take the inside route, which you don't normally do at Epsom. Because of the camber, tired horses always fall down to the rail and then fall back on you. So most jockeys try to angle out for a bit of clear daylight. But I only had one bite of the cherry, so it was all or nothing. And I nipped up the inside, and fortunately, it all panned out.
And you said earlier on you've been lucky at Epsom. Do you think you're lucky at Epsom, or do you think, because it's a tricky, famously tricky course, don't be modest here, do you think you really ride it quite well?
Well, I suppose I'd like to think so. Epsom, it's a weird track. I can't explain it unless you ride it. This might sound stupid, but if you've ever seen, I can't surf, I've never done it in my life, but you watch people, these surfers, they, when you get a big wave, you have to ride it and go with it. If you try and fight against it, then it catches you out and it goes wrong. And I see some jockeys do that. Like, they try and drag horses up the camber when they're not handling it. They try and do things. You have to just go with it. And I used to watch, Kieran Fallon was brilliant around Epsom because he was always so relaxed and he'd take everything in as it comes. And you kind of have to go with the gradients, don't fight them. And you, it's almost like you have to tame the beast that is Epsom. And a lot of jockeys fall foul of it. And I think I try and be relaxed and go with it. And that's what I've always done. And it's always stood me in good stead.
And post Sir Percy, there's a great story because your late dad was Martin as well. And my former colleague, now retired, Colin McKenzie of the Daily Mail, called you on the Sunday morning and your dad answered the phone. Just to paint us a quick picture of how that all went.
That was brilliant, sir. Because it was surreal that I'd actually won the Derby. It was like crazy and all friends and that turned up. And we decided to have a party on that Sunday. Me and my wife, Claire, we went out to get a load of champagne and stuff for this barbecue party and left me dad in charge at home, which is always a dangerous thing. But obviously I'm named Martin after him. So the phone rang and he answered it and the voice on the other end was, "Hello, Martin, Colin McKenzie here." And my dad's like, "Hello, Colin, how are you, mate?" I didn't know who he was at all. So now Colin thinks he's talking to me. My dad hasn't got a clue who he's talking to. And he says, well done for yesterday. And my dad says, oh, best day of my life, Colin, best day of my life. So there on in, he conducts an interview for 7 or 8 minutes about the derby. And they just carry on, and neither of them know who they're talking to. And then I think Colin McKenzie twigged when he asked him, he said, were you nervous, Martin? To which my dad responded, oh, he said, I was a bag of nerves. He said, I don't normally drink in the afternoon, but I had to have a few pints before the race. And Colin's like, what? And he said, yeah, I had a few pints and a whiskey. He said, by the time we crossed the line, I didn't know what was happening. So I think that's when he twigged, thank God.
Oh dear, he was. I think if you are a wit and a raconteur and a comic and a joker, etc., I think we know where you got it from, because those of us who knew your dad, he was much the same. Look, 15 years on, pile driver. What about maybe a repeat?
Yeah, 14 years on. You're trying to age me even more. I've told you about this.
Yeah, my maths has never been that good. 14 years on, then you're at it again with pile driver.
Yeah, I know, isn't it amazing? 14 years, where's it gone? But that probably shows you how hard it is to find a horse good enough with the qualities to run and have a chance in the Epsom Derby. And he's the closest I've got. You know, it's taken me 14 years to find one, and fingers crossed he goes there with a cracking chance.
So his credentials for anyone thinking about, because he's sort of 12, 14, 16 to one. Something like that. What would you say his big plus points were? Obviously, he won the Edward VII Stakes of Royal Ascot to start with.
Yeah, he's an improving horse. He won first time out last year, and he won a listed race, and then he went very weak the end of his two-year-old campaign. He was like, I rode him at Newmarket, and his last run as a two-year-old, and he was like Bambi on ice. He was legs everywhere, but he's really matured well as a three-year-old, and this extra, you know, we're a month later this year for the Derby, aren't we? So this extra month has benefited him in as an individual. He's strengthened up. He won it really convincingly at Ascot. He showed he's got the stamina for a mile and a half. He'll go on any ground. And more importantly, he's got the ability. And what he did at Ascot, which impressed me, he quickened twice. A good horse can quicken more than once. Ordinary run-of-the-mill horses, they normally only quicken once, but he quickened to get me where I needed to be at Ascot, quickened through to take the gap, and then he's left in front two out, and then he quickened again when a horse challenged him. So he showed a lot of plus points to take to Epsom.
And just looking at the other runners, I won't go through all of them, but English King, your mate Frankie Dettori on board, and Kamiko, well touted, trained by the Balding family. So it'd be like a reunion at the start.
Yeah, well, I wish them all the best and hope the second. I actually think Andrew's horse is the one to beat. He's got the class.
Kamiko.
Yeah, Kamiko won the Guineas. And if he stays the mile and a half, he's the one we all have to beat. But I think there's a question mark there with him staying.
And if it worked out again, have you imagined what it'd be like to go and win a derby for a second time? And we should point out, Pile Driver is trained by your father-in-law, William Muir. So, goodness, that would be quite something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'll make it extra special, won't it? Because it's hard, you know, William's got 60 horses in at the moment. He's not a big yard like Andrew and John Gosden, and he's bigger trainer, so it's harder for them to get these horses. So it just makes it extra special, and you know, it's a family theme there. I just better not mess up, and I also be nowhere. I won't be invited for Christmas lunch, will I?
Well, I'm just wondering, riding for your father-in-law, is that must have plus points, but negative points as well, if things do go wrong, because you've got to see him again.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's not just a phone call and then, you know, get over it. But, we've worked together for years. We know each other well, and William understands things go wrong and you have to accept it. But, no, listen, if when things go right, we enjoy it more. We've had a Royal Ascot winner, and whatever else this horse does on Saturday, he's going to be a fun horse. He's going to be around for a while, and hopefully there's big races to be won with him.
And I detect it's actually your birthday in Derby week, and I'm going to tell the truth. I know you've been telling everyone you're 29, but you were 45, and quite a lot of the people riding around you, Kamikobe ridden by Oshin Murphy, who could practically be your son, Tom Marquand will be riding in the race, could practically be your son. It must be quite satisfying that you're right in the forefront of things with those youngsters around.
Yeah, it's of course. Things have changed over the years. I mean, there's some really good young jockeys coming through. Obviously, Ocean and Tom, you've mentioned, they're class riders and they're making a name for themselves. And in sport, things change. And any walk of life, you've got young lads coming through, effectively taking our jobs and that.
The new Martin Dwyers.
Yeah, that's it. But in racing, you know, it's unlike other sports because the horse does most of the work. And experience counts. So I'd like to think I bring a lot more experience. They'll be a lot more nervous than I will come Saturday. And I will definitely be having a few words with Tom and O'Shea, telling him be careful and trying to put them off. And they will be nervous. With the likes of me and Frankie, we've been there before, seen it, done it. So I'd like to think I've got that in my arsenal, where a few of these will just be worrying a little bit.
And as I say, you are 45. Frankie's nearly 50.
You stop mentioning my age.
Well, you talk about you're very experienced, obviously, especially around Epsom. You know, if he won, flying dismount, and then actually, I couldn't top this. I'll go and retire, or will you? Are you going to be galloping on for a few years to come?
I'll keep going as long as my body lets me, and if it looks like the game's giving me up, then I'll pack up. But I'm 45. I've got a few years left in me yet, so I'm not even thinking about that.
Excellent. Well, pleased to hear that. Well, look, thank you for joining me, Martin, on the Cornelius Cast today, and the very best of luck with Pile Driver in the Derby at Epsom on July the 4th. Thank you to you too for listening. Please think about subscribing so you don't miss an episode. We'll speak again soon.